This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's Monday. That means it's time for our special series, The State We're In, about legislative trends at the state level. Next month in the midterms, four states have ballot initiatives that would change how they draw voting districts. Instead of lawmakers drawing their own lines, independent redistricting commissions would take over. 21 states already have these commissions. Supporters say independent commissions help make districts more competitive. Critics say it's too much power to give unelected officials. Joining us to discuss it is Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
Also with us is David Daly, a senior fellow at Fair Vote, a nonprofit focused on electoral reform. David is also the author of an upcoming book about redistricting called The Rising. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
And joining us from WGVU Public Radio in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is Katie Fahey. She's the founder and executive director of Voters Not Politicians, which is based in Grand Rapids. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Hello, glad to be here.
We'd love to hear from you too, especially if redistricting is a hot topic where you live. Is there something on the ballot next month for voters in your community to decide? And how are you thinking through whether you might vote for or against whatever's on the ballot? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@wamu.org. Katie, you're on the ground in Michigan working on redistricting reform. I want to hear what you're up to in just a moment, but first I want to get a little more explanation of this larger issue. And so, Reed Wilson, let me start with you. If you would just explain what we mean when we talk about redistricting and at what point redistricting becomes gerrymandering.
Right. So this is a process that the United States goes through every 10 years after the decennial census. The census really starts the whole process. The U.S. Census Bureau eventually gives the states the official number of their population and then the number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives they'll get. There's a really complicated math formula called the Huntington Hill method, which I still haven't quite figured out, even though I've been staring at it for a couple of years. But that's how every state, all 50 states, get one member of the House of Representatives, at least. You know, there are 435. So that eliminate those first 50 seats that everybody gets. And then the 51st seat is awarded to the largest state using the Huntington Hill method. So California gets the 51st state. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they get the 52nd seat as well. But then the seats are allocated by population all the way down to the 435th. And that's how we figure out that, say, you know, Washington State has 10 districts this time, or California has 53, and whether or not they're going to gain or lose a seat on the margins depending on the population shifts and the relative populations of each state. So this happens every 10 years, and then the U.S. Constitution gives the state legislatures the power to draw those district lines. Now, that clause has been interpreted in different ways. Some legislatures have challenged the various independent commissions around the country so that they can maintain that power. Mm-hmm. Other states, other legislators have more willingly given up that power to an independent commission. But basically, every state does it in its own way, in some with some, you know, various quirks here and there. And the legislatures will then draw those maps, and the district lines are meant to go in place by the 2022 congressional elections. So the U.S. Census happens in 2020. The official numbers are given to the states about a year later, and then the states have about a year to draw the district lines. Everybody knows pretty much where the districts are going to be, right, with the minor tweaks that happen here and there. And when we get to gerrymandering, yeah, I mean, that's when that's sort of the pejorative term for when a party draws district lines that are meant to favor their candidate in crazy ways, in ways that where the communities are divided to diminish one side's political power or bolster another side's political power. And you know, throughout the years, every state has gone through its own hiccups with political gerrymandering. It's become a dirty word now, and it's something that we're going to see thrown around a lot in this next redistricting cycle.
Yeah, North Carolina is one of those states that's got quite a few stories to tell about redistricting and gerrymandering. And David, you are in Charlotte following the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, which Eric Holder is leading. We had him on this program to talk about it a while back. Give us a sense, David, of what's at stake politically with redrawing these district lines, particularly with North Carolina being this kind of interesting example of redistricting and the efforts to reform it.
I think there's an awful lot at stake. If you think about it this way, if you look at the five competitive swing states of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, you might imagine that those five competitive swing states send a similar number of members of Congress of both parties to Washington, except the reality is dramatically different. Those five states send 48 Republicans and 21 Democrats to Washington. Democrats have only been successful in flipping one seat red to blue in any of those competitive states in this entire decade, and that's the Connor Lamb seat in the special election in 2017. So in the 2012, 2014, and 2016 elections, there was no swing in any district in any of these competitive swing states. You also see this as well at the state legislative level. So you have all of these states that are closely divided, like, say, North Carolina, states in which Democrats may often win more votes statewide for a chamber. And yet here, for example, Republicans have a supermajority in both the state assembly and also in the state Senate. So they're able to completely override the actions of a Democratic governor here. It makes politics more extreme. It insulates members from voters. It allows them to do things like the transgender bathroom bill that's, you know, wildly unpopular, and yet the politicians, feel completely empowered to go ahead and enact that kind of legislation. And it also discourages competition in a lot of these seats. In North Carolina in 2016, 49% of all statewide seats went without a major party competitor. So voters had no choice in almost half of their districts here because folks took a look at those races and said, I can't win or raise enough money to actually make it worth the investment of time.
Glad to get to some of your comments as well. Clearly, gerrymandering is, as some of you who are fans of the show know, one of our audience's hottest topics, including with Michael, who wrote on our Facebook page, any party that requires gerrymandering to stay in power doesn't deserve power. This shouldn't be partisan. Michael writes, Ohio is heavily gerrymandered. However, in an election earlier this year, voters heavily approved, with support from both parties, an issue on the ballot to fairly redraw districts after 2020. And Laura writes, Pennsylvania was gerrymandered. They rewrote the map, but I do not believe they were making it active for this 2018 election. Ain't that a load of crap? That's also the same in North Carolina, Laura. By the way, we did a program a while back in February, actually, about gerrymandering, where we put a quiz online. We have some gerrymandered districts, and we wanted to see if you could tell the difference between the map of a gerrymandered district and an ink blot on a Rorschach test. You can find that quiz if you search the word gerrymandering, G-E-R-R-Y-M-A-N-D-E-R-I-N-G. It was a program that aired this February. You'll find that on our website, the1a.org. Katie, let me come to you. Talk about voters, not politicians. I understand that this is a redistricting initiative that got started after you were trying to find some way to be politically active but not overtly hyper-partisan. And this is something that galvanized people around you, right?
Yeah, I accidentally started a political movement with a Facebook post. It was after the 2016 election, before headed to a Thanksgiving dinner. And I had heard my friends and family really being drawn to both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders with these messages about draining the swamp and the political revolution. And I realized that, you know, there's a lot of frustration against the current system in place, which makes a lot of sense. I remember learning about gerrymandering, and it does make it so that our voices aren't heard or that popular proposals aren't being passed at the local level. And we're lucky in Michigan where we have the citizen-led ballot initiative process, which means if we can write constitutional language as the people of Michigan and then gather this last round 315,654 registered Michigan voter signatures, then we can have the people in the general election vote directly on a constitutional amendment. And so with that Facebook post, a group of us internet strangers ended up deciding we wanted to work on something that would be good for any Michigan voter. no matter whether they were a Democrat, a Republican, independent, something else. It was really remarkable because we're now an organization of over 14,000 volunteers across our state who have really kind of put our lives on hold for the last 2 years to try and pass redistricting reform where we can have an independent citizens redistricting commission drawing these lines instead. And that's where our name comes from, too, so that voters will draw the lines and not politicians.
You've got some support in our audience. Melody wrote on our Facebook page, "In Michigan, we hope to amend our constitution to take redistricting away from the governor's appointed henchmen. Fingers crossed." Katie, what made you decide to do this by a ballot initiative as opposed to going through the legislative process?
Yeah, so we were looking at, there's really three options to go about this, at least in Michigan. One was we could have brought a lawsuit, but actually the League of Women Voters, quickly after we were kind of thinking about it, they ended up bringing a lawsuit against the current maps. And really, lawsuits are great because they will help right any wrongs that were done, but it doesn't change who's drawing these lines. And I really think unless you get politicians out of the driver's seat for these decisions, you're always going to have a conflict of interest that is putting partisan politics above the actual people of your state. And so then we were like, okay, well, let's try and see if we could work with the legislature. After doing some research, we saw that there had been over 11 bills actually written by different members in our Congress, but they were either only written by Republicans or only written by Democrats, depending who had been doing the most recent gerrymandering. And none of them had ever even been adopted up into a vote. So we saw pretty quickly that that was not a good route to go. So then I think a lot of us really felt like we're tired of compromise. Politicians don't have a large incentive to give themselves less power. So if we're going to make this systemic change, then it really does have to come for and by the people of our state, because otherwise it's going to be a solution that just continues on putting power with politicians or special interests instead of the actual people. So it's really been amazing, though. I mean, we had thousands of people. We did these town halls, 33 in 33 days, where we went and talked to people about what is gerrymandering? What does it look like in Michigan? What does it look like in other states? And then we had a big, long survey asking people their preferences on who do you think should draw these lines and how should we be drawing these districts? What kind of data should be used? And then how do you want the process to look? And it really has been a statewide effort in all 83 counties of Michigan, which has been a really inspiring thing to be a part of.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Reed Wilson, can you walk us through the ballot measures in four states? They would be changing, they would charge independent commissions with redistricting instead of legislators. Can you just quickly kind of run through what those four initiatives are?
Yeah, so the four states, you talked to Katie in Michigan. Missouri has something on the ballot, too. Colorado and Utah are the two other states. And by and large, the contours of these ballot measures are largely the same. They would create independent commissions. You know, there are differences on the margins in terms of the number of people on the commissions or how they're appointed or things like that. But those commissions would include some Democrats, some Republicans, and crucially, independent or unaffiliated voters. And in most cases, those unaffiliated voters have to vote with a supermajority, which would probably include at least some members from the minority party, too, so that everybody has a stake in the final maps, and the point is to pass maps that at least pass muster with some members of both parties in order to come up with some kind of comprehensive and fair process. That's what's happened in Ohio earlier this year that you mentioned. That's the template that Arizona and California, the two real pioneers in this independent commission, did in a little more than a decade ago now. After the 2000s, when the first real effort to reform this came up. And we're seeing that in efforts to do this in most states where there are where ballot measures are allowed, where citizens are allowed to put measures on the ballot, there are at least some rumblings about other initiatives of this type coming up in future years.
David, it seems like one of the challenges with making these commissions is what the composition of them would be, whether they are nonpartisan or bipartisan or independent, just who gets to be on them and how those people are appointed and how many terms they serve and who gets to put them on and take them off. I wonder what you see in terms of the nitty-gritty of how these commissions come together and what the party compositions of them are and what impact that has.
I think that's exactly right. These commissions really are only as good as the people who serve on them, the way that they're chosen, and then the criteria that they're given to do their work. And what you see in many states where the commissions are essentially appointed by the political process, so say a bipartisan commission that works in Washington State or in New Jersey, these are essentially incumbent protection gerrymanders. These are both parties coming together and dividing up the seats. You also have the example of Arizona, which I think is, you know, really instructive, because it was passed as a nonpartisan commission, except the way that they constituted it, you have Democrats essentially picking two members, Republicans picking two members. So immediately you have, you know, four fierce partisans at loggerheads on this commission. And then there's one independent chair who is chosen through the state appellate court personnel process. So the goal is to try to find an independent, except Republicans think last time that the Democrats found a way to, you know, work a Trojan horse Democrat onto the panel who voted alongside the two liberals and created a set of maps that have been better for the Democrats this decade than for the Republicans. Whether or not that's actually true, they believe it, and they're determined to work the same process in 2020 and to try to, you know, game that process, you know, right there at the independent chair level. So if you only have a five-person commission and four people are partisans, you are going to not get a super good process out of this.
Right. So, David, I know we're coming up to a break. I hate to cut you short, and we're having a little bit of glitchiness on your line. Not your fault, but we'll iron that out during the break. But it sounds like what you're saying is that you have these nonpartisan commissions where they basically appoint bureaucrats to go draw the lines, then these bipartisan commissions where existing partisans try to work their differences out, and then you have a place like California where the goal is to kind of empower citizens to draw the districts themselves.
I think that's exactly right. California and these other initiatives this year as well, you know, Colorado and Michigan, are trying to find actual citizens to do this. And California certainly proved that actual citizens can do this and do it really well.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with David Daly, senior fellow at FairVote, Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and Katie Fahey, the founder and executive director of Voters Not Politicians. Got plenty of comments from you, including quite a few, complaining about the impact of Republicans on gerrymandered districts. Is this really an issue that mostly affects Republicans, or are Democrats just kind of getting away with not getting the criticism they deserve? Stay close. Quick word about what we'll be discussing this time tomorrow. It'll be a conversation about how we all behave at work. Chances are that you have worked somewhere that made you feel like you had to be perfect, show no fear, never screw up, and avoid asking for help. Not the easiest working conditions, but what else is there? Researcher Brené Brown argues that the same kind of empathy we seek in our personal lives should carry over to our workplaces if we want to do our best. We would like to know if you have ever worked somewhere like that, a company where you felt safe to be yourself, your whole self. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. How much are you able to be yourself at work? Does your company feel like a safe place to just be human? Or do you have to armor up before you clock in every day? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a high-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We will share some of your stories when Brené Brown joins us in studio tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Katie Fahey, the founder and executive director of Voters Not Politicians, David Daly, senior fellow at FairVote and the author of the upcoming book, The Rising, and Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. A couple of you wrote us to respond to Laura's message about Pennsylvania's redrawn maps not being in place for this year's election. Mark writes that the new Pennsylvania congressional maps are effective this election cycle. Steve writes, the state Supreme Court had to intervene to get us fairer districts. Some were so badly gerrymandered, the districts formed pictures. Look at the old 7th congressional district. Thankfully, the new districts are in force for 2018. And some of them say that the 7th congressional district in Pennsylvania looks like Goofy and Donald Duck facing one another. Seriously, Google it. Speaking of which, Maurice tweeted, gerrymandering has transcended the political realm and infiltrated the fashion world. He sent us a link to a website called gerrymanderjewelry.com. This is a thing. Gerrymander Jewelry has all these pictures, six in fact, of voting districts. The North Carolina 6th District, Texas's 35th District, Louisiana 6th, Florida 4th, Michigan 14th, and Ohio's 1st District. And they're selling them as jewelry, $195 each. But the proceeds benefit a political action group that is trying to get more Democratic governors, secretaries of state, and attorneys general elected in six key Republican-controlled states. We got a lot of comments, Reed, about the role of Republicans in gerrymandering. Scott wrote on our Facebook page, I live in Virginia. The GOP is dragging its feet on this because they barely held on to a majority with the current map that's gerrymandered in their favor. They're simply trying to push this past the 2018 election to stem their losses. Is that fair? I don't think that the Republicans have cornered the market on gerrymandering. Neither party wants to be disadvantaged. But what do we know?
Well, the Virginia example, he's talking about the House of Delegates, and the Democrats came within one seat of winning back the House of Delegates back in 2017. The way Virginia elections work, the delegates are elected in odd-numbered years, so it doesn't actually have anything to do with the 2018 election. There have been some federal challenges to the congressional district lines in Virginia, but there's a difference between the state legislative districts, which is sort of part of a larger story of how Republicans locked in a lot of their gains in the U.S. House of Representatives. But those are two different things. You're exactly right. No party is blameless in this. Gerrymandering started. We get the word from a guy named Elbridge Gerry, who was the governor of Massachusetts back in 1812. He drew a district line that effectively packed all of the members of the Federalist Party into one district, and that allowed his party, the Democratic Republicans, imagine if those still existed today, to win all the districts around it. A newspaper in Boston took a look at the map. They said it looked like a salamander. It was Jerry's salamander. It was a gerrymander. Oh. So that's how we actually get the word. And so, yeah, this has been happening since like the beginning of the Republic. You could argue that some of this happened back in Athenian democracy back in, you know, 500 BCE. But when we talk about today, yeah, both parties do this. Look, Democrats controlled the House of Representatives from 1954 to 1994, and they did it in a large part by drawing favorable districts in the South that were meant to lock in their members and in large degree to discriminate against African-American voters. And now, even today, we see some challenges to district lines drawn by Democrats, especially in the state of Maryland. There's one district out in western Maryland that used to be held by a Republican until Democrats redrew the lines, and now it's a safe Democratic seat. So yes, both parties do this. Republicans have done it more publicly lately, and so therefore they are getting the heat. But yeah, when we start hearing about fair district lines, that generally comes from the people who think that the lines aren't fair and therefore are probably the ones who are losing elections. That's not to diminish the fact that these lines may not be fair,
right,
but the people who cry fairness tend to be the ones who are not holding the pencils, if you will.
We do get comments from folks on both sides of the aisle complaining about how both sides of the aisle tend to gerrymander. Harry wrote on our Facebook page, the GOP is going nuts in Colorado over ballot initiatives to redistrict via a nonpartisan commission. Slow D tweeted, I wish this was such a hot topic back when Democrats in my state had districts in the shape of a pencil. Joanne wrote on our Facebook page, redistricting reform has been an issue for several years in Indiana, as we have a supermajority Republican General Assembly, a Republican governor, and a state Supreme Court with a majority appointed by Republican governors and approved by the Republican legislators. Nothing will change as long as the gerrymandered legislative branch is controlled by one party. Several bills have been put forward with lip service from leadership, then killed by Republican chairmen who do not believe that Indiana is gerrymandered and say so publicly. Katie Fahey, I wonder if this gets back to something that you said earlier about trying to find something political but not partisan. Can you give me a sense of some of the conversations you've had with folks or that you've been witness to, of folks kind of talking across the aisle about this? Does this feel practically to you on the ground like a unifying issue?
Yeah, my experience really has been that. I mean, in Michigan, though, we have had Democrats and Republicans control the line drawing process. So maybe that helps. But we have volunteers who are Democrats, Republicans, independents. And I think that what we've seen is that no matter which party is in charge in Michigan, the really common sense things that we all look to government to at least help provide basic things like clean water or roads that aren't falling apart. Those things aren't happening no matter who's in charge. And, you know, there's also Detroit is pretty gerrymandered. They try and pack a lot of Democrats into one district, but there are still Republicans who live in those districts, and so their voices aren't heard. Or because a lot of these races are happening in the primaries, and we don't really have competitive elections at the statewide level in Michigan, we hear a lot of people talking about, even if they're the official that is their representative is the party they like, they're much more extreme than what they would like to see. And so I think that in Michigan in particular, people have just had enough. We feel like our government's doing a lot of overreach, and we want to help restore some transparency in the system, especially if we're consistently ranked one of the least transparent states when it comes to transparency in government. And that's the biggest thing we heard while we were doing those town halls, is a lot of people saying, you know, I don't know why these lines are being drawn. And then 8 years later, some emails coming out talking directly about how these lines were drawn to guarantee one party an advantage over another. And people are tired of it. They want to be looked at as having our politicians accountable to us and not special interests. Right. What's been really cool, too, is that you see a lot of families who have joined Voters Not Politicians to volunteer together. Even for my family, it did work after that Thanksgiving dinner.
Even for your family?
Yeah. My mom gathered 500 signatures and is canvassing every day. We've got 30 days till the election. So it's been really exciting. And you see a lot of people who are like, you know, there's nothing that we agree on, but I really like working on this issue because the basic concepts of fairness and an impartial system and a system that puts the people first, I think those are some of our core democratic values that when you think about America, you think about that. And it resonates with people across the aisle, and not always with the people who are right now in charge, but the average voter, we see support across the aisle.
Meredith wrote on our Facebook page, I just volunteered with Voters Not Politicians on Friday. Everyone we canvassed was very receptive to the idea once they learned about the ballot initiative. The key is education and getting everyone to vote. David Daly, I wonder if we could get a little critical with this idea of the redistricting commission. I don't want people to think that this is just a panacea, that if we just put it in the hands of someone other than a politician, everything will be fine. Have there ever been occasions when redistricting commissions did not work or made things worse?
Sure. I think that the example in Arizona, for example, is a commission that, you know, simply, you know, malfunctioned and did nothing to take this process out of the back rooms of politicians and kind of put it in front of the people. You have lots of commissions that appear to be independent on face, like the ones in New Jersey, Washington State. They're actually simply commissions that allow both sides to gerrymander together under the guise of nonpartisanship. That does not make a better system either. There are, you know, lots of other ways we could go about this. You know, Congressman Don Beyer has a bill up called the Fair Representation Act that involves, you know, larger multi-member districts and folks elected by ranked choice voting. You know, that's another way of looking at this and going about it. But there are going to be, you know, a lot of changes here. I think as Brett Kavanaugh takes a seat on the Supreme Court, you've had reformers for the last decade pinning their hopes on Anthony Kennedy and a national standard there. That road for a national standard appears to be closed. And in fact, you might now have five justices on the court who frown on the very idea of independent commissions at all. So what you might be looking at are legislative fixes as well, you know, something that opens up the process, that, you know, guarantees transparency, that, you know, mandates that Folks who are drawing these lines can't favor or disfavor any political party or candidate. There are all kinds of supercomputers that can draw, you know, 25,000 sample lines and perhaps force politicians to test the extreme districts that they draw up against nonpartisan lines.
Right.
So, I mean, I think we're going to have to look at other ways of doing this, especially as we run out of states that are allowed to take this on the ballot.
You may also be interested in our program that we did on ranked choice voting earlier this year. You'll find that online at the1a.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. I know our time is short, but Reed Wilson, I wanted to get your sense about how the U.S. Supreme Court has factored into redistricting. It has never struck down a map for partisan gerrymandering. There's now a new Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh, on the court. What's your read of the future of redistricting, gerrymandering, figuring out this whole thing before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, as David was mentioning, we were all sort of waiting for Anthony Kennedy to come up with some kind of standard that could be applied across the country. But a number of cases in places like Virginia and North Carolina have been remanded back to lower courts. So we're still waiting for a real honest-to-God challenge that actually makes it to the Supreme Court and resolves itself in some way other than a sort of a punt back to a lower court.
And the issue, Reed, I'm sorry to interrupt. I know we're short on time, but it seems like the issue is really just trying to define gerrymandering in a legal sense. Like, we have a definition of obscenity from Miller versus California in 1973. Like, there's a checklist. Literally, there's just a checklist you go through. Something is obscene if. But we don't have a checklist to define the line between redistricting and gerrymandering.
And we don't even have a definition as to whether or not gerrymandering is illegal or unconstitutional. And by the way, let's also define the phrase fair. What are we looking for when we talk about a fair redistricting process? Is it compact districts? Is it districts that encourage competition? I'll tell you, in my home state of Washington, the commission that gets together is appointed by the House and Senate Democratic and Republican conferences. Those four people get together and elect a fifth nonpartisan person. They always come up with a 5-0 map that everybody gets along with. And their goal is to create a district that will be, or at least a few districts that will be Democratic and a few districts that will be Republican, so that Washington State has a member of the majority party in Congress so that they can get something back, you know, when they need to. But the fact is, you know, what is fair? Is it competition in November? Is it having representation from minority groups? There's a district in the Chicago suburbs that looks like an alligator with its jaws open. That district makes sense because it's about 72% Hispanic. So the very large Hispanic population in Chicago that lives in differing neighborhoods has a representative in Congress. I'd argue that's fair.
One last question, David Daly, that we've gotten quite a bit of. You mentioned computers. Anna asked, instead of allowing people to redraw districts, why not give the task to artificial intelligence? They could probably draw much fairer, evenly distributed lines based on square mileage, and the process would no longer be partisan. David, I wonder if the challenge with that is figuring out what to tell the computer to do, or are we at that point now before we go?
I think Reed is right. I think that there are so many competing values here and that people have to decide what values they want out of representation. These are, you know, very basic questions. And sometimes those values are in conflict with one another. Do you want districts that are contiguous and compact? Well, a district that is compact around a city might, you know, simply elect all Democrats. So those districts might not necessarily be competitive. So a lot of these values are in tension, and we as people ought to talk about them and work out those values. Supercomputers are amazing in this, though. I think what they have done is they have shown that the maps that politicians produce are very extreme. And in a state like North Carolina or in Michigan, you can run, you know, 25,000 draft maps off of the criteria that the politicians are given, and you can see exactly how you never get the extreme outcomes on one end. If you could work into the process as supercomputers, that would be great, but I would not turn it over to them.
And before we go, speaking of Michigan, Katie Fahey, if your initiative passes, will you be involved with the commission in any way? What will be next for you, briefly?
The biggest thing is we want to make sure that people now know that they can serve on this commission. So we'll want to go out and keep raising awareness that you can apply if you're a registered voter. And also then people will actually for the first time be invited into this process so they can go and give testimony about how they want their community to be represented. So we're going to make sure that we're making sure the people know that they could now be involved in redistricting.
Katie Fahey of Voters Not Politicians, Reed Wilson of The Hill, and David Daly of Fair Vote. Thank you all for speaking with us. This show was produced by James Morrison, Danielle Knight, and Steph Collette. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.